Yo voy a intentar volar hacia el desastre y después voy a irme a un
I'm going to talk about disaster and then I'm going to talk about a more optimistic world. But disaster because of where we are, because funding is falling continuously. This is June this year and this is the quarterly financial forecast. And they're saying that we'll only see a slight sign of recovery by the end of 2013. So the economy will continue to contract, and so both donations and ticket sales and public funding will continue to fall. But of course, these forecasts, and that's why they're talking about the first hints of recovery and what have you, economists base on the data of the past, because we can use the past data to predict the future. And of course, when there's a turning point in a very volatile environment like this one, we can't really predict when that will happen exactly. And I don't want to be too optimistic, but I'd say that the only indicator we handle, which does hint at a recovery, is this one, the Summarized Activity Index, which is produced by the Institute of Official Statistics for the Ministry. And what this says is that whatever comes up there will happen two semesters later. So it anticipates what might happen in the future. So for two quarters now, it seems that these figures have been getting more positive, which means that we would end T4 with slightly better results, which is why the government suddenly deciding we have a bright future ahead and better times around the corner and what have you, and people laugh. But I just wanted to tell you that the forecasts we're making are not that reliable because they're based on past data extrapolated towards the future. Since we're running a little late, I'll speed up. And all I can say is that 20% of our businesses have gone under. And of course, millions of people have lost their jobs. And this industrial fabric has to be rebuilt. We're going to find a way to turn this around, and we don't know how. Plus, the country is highly indebted. We owe 350% of GDP. That is, we would have to spend 3.5 years without eating anything to repay what we owe. Of this 350% of GDP, 80% is owed by the state. The rest is by the businesses, which are your sponsors mostly, and households. So this is the current environment. People are trying to repay their debts, and that's why the economy is in recession without really moving forward much. And if we ask why this has happened, and that's why we need to change things, we will realize that we're not a very competitive country. As soon as things go well, we start buying foreign products. And we don't sell products abroad. If we think about how many things we wear that are manufactured in Spain or that we use, there aren't many, if any. And if you look at the countries that have had more of a current account deficit, this was before the crisis, 2008, 2009, Greece, second Spain, then Portugal, three countries that have been bailed out or are on the verge, Australia, the UK, and Ireland. And the countries in the euro have major difficulties, and the ones that have more of leeway because they can depreciate their currency can emerge from these situations more easily, while we have to adjust everything based on costs. And that's why when they tell me that we're not going to reduce the costs of our musicians and so on, it's going to be very difficult because that's the adjustment that's having to be made because we can't do other things. But that's what I'm going to suggest. This was the Spanish model. This is the crisis of 82 when the Socialist Party came to power. There were two currency depreciations. Then the economy grew, strong upswing until 1993, then four depreciations, again a recovery. And now we're in a crisis, but of course we can't depreciate the currency. And so emerging from this is more difficult, more slow. Think about what drove the Spanish economy during the cycle. It was the construction sector, the World Fair, the Olympics, the high-speed railways, the motorways. So it was all public works and the construction sector. So it was the state that became highly indebted. And then after that, it was the housing sector. So again, the construction sector and the households became indebted. But it was always the same sector, construction, which requires a lot of funding and finance when there's been such a financial crisis. And we also have to point out that the construction sector represented 20% of Spain's GDP, 12% directly, and 8% real estate development. Next sector is hotels and tourism, that's 6%. We don't have another sector that can take over. And that's why we're finding it so difficult to emerge from this crisis. And if you look at where money was invested over these years, 2006, 7, 8, 9, everything was invested in mortgages, in developer loans. This is consumer loans, and this is industrial loans. And things would have been very different if credit had gone elsewhere. And that's something we need to learn. So is Spain entirely adrift, like this galleon, which can only sail successfully with tailwind? And if you have a crosswind or a headwind, where it become mired? Well, I don't know. But the thing is that we have to change. We have to do things differently. And we have to do it in a world which changes very fast, in a global economy which is no longer going to be the same. Because in the past, the poor countries were financing the rich countries so that they could live beyond their means. And this just cannot continue. You cannot have China saving 40% of their income in order to lend to Americans so that Americans can live beyond their means, buying products from the Chinese so the Chinese can again save 40% and lend it to the Americans. And the financial sector collecting savings in a country like China and giving it to the US. That just cannot continue. So this will not happen again. The Chinese are beginning to foster internal demand, and the US, after the elections, will have to begin their adjustments. So the world will need to change. We don't know what it will be like, but it will have to be different. On the other hand, the EU is an area which is not protectionist. I can't protect my products through tariff barriers. I can't do what was traditionally done since the 19th century to protect myself against foreign competition, which is what Spain used to do in the past. And this time, it's just not possible, particularly when there's no currency depreciation possible and when there's a financial crisis in a country that needs finance. So that's the environment. We have to be competitive, and we have to be able to rebuild our industrial fabric. The concept of competitiveness is difficult to define, but I like to describe it as follows. First, the definition of a commercial area. That is, I have to be more competitive than others in the same commercial area. And in our case, it's Germany, France, Italy, and the UK. And part of this country is tremendously competitive and successful. And that's what we need to foster to drive the economy. But we're not Greece. We're not a country without a future. It's only part of our industrial fabric, which is powerful and successful and exporting. And so that's why I am moderately optimistic in the sense that we will emerge from this crisis, but there will be part of this country which is resistant to change and preventing change for others. And now that I've defined this commercial area, competitiveness is about this depreciation, which we know is over. That was the traditional way of fixing the problem, always, since the 19th century or even earlier. We depreciated the currency. We never made any major changes. We never reformed fully. It was always a defense game. Second, inflation, prices. Our prices are higher than those of the countries we compete against, and they're still rising in spite of the current crisis. So we have an inflationary pressure due to VAT or wage negotiations, what have you. But we're always in this inflation spiral, and that makes us less competitive still. Thirdly, costs. And in costs, we're talking about wages, but also energy, finance, raw materials, technology, and transaction costs. And this is a country which needs simplification. Everything is really difficult. Everything's always late. The administrative burden is huge. Everything takes forever. And so we have to simplify. Transaction costs are an essential component. And here we have something that doesn't cost any money. It's just about doing things differently. It's about establishing more direct relations and more direct route. And then we have a basic element, which is productivity. And productivity is not about lowering wages. That's costs. Productivity is the value that I generate per working hour. And in general, economists always look at productivity by saying you have to generate the same amount with fewer hours of work. So we want more efficiency. But we forget the top part, which is what I'd like to focus on, and that's the value part. We have to create value, and it's not about same value, fewer hours, or to create the same value more efficiently or with lower costs. Why don't we think about creating more value and see where we can find that value and how we can create it? So I don't want Spain to compete in efficiency, and certainly not in wages, because Spain cannot compete in wages. That would mean worse living conditions for all of us, and our ability to consume would be really low. So we need high wages, but we can only have that by increasing efficiency, certainly, but also by creating more value. And this is what we don't know how to do. And when companies think about where they're creating value, they use this sort of diagram, which I think you need to keep in mind. And that's the value chain. It's the traditional value chain, which I think is a bit obsolete. But let's look at it, because it's easy to understand. Companies say, I can create value by buying or manufacturing or selling. And they focus on where they create value. Where do you create value? This is a question that I think we should cover. And then we can have more complex value chains, including logistics, operations, sales, marketing. You can add to that whatever you like. But where is our value? It's in the artists, in the quality of the performance, or in what we call our social value. What do people value? Going to the theater, meeting with celebrities, being seen and being seen. Something that we all enjoy. Networking is important, but at the same time, you have quality and you have the artists and the performance. And perhaps each orchestra generates value in a different way. For some, the most important thing is the artistic performance. For others, it's the networking, socializing. And for others, it's the quality of the performance, the music. And of course, when we're talking about value, and value is whatever people are willing to pay for. People don't pay, we're not creating enough value, clearly. So who is paying for this? Well, basically, our audience. And we talked every morning about live music and appreciating live music, and people are willing to pay for that. Others prefer listening to it on the radio or buying a record or watching it on television, are willing to pay for that. And then we have private sponsors. But what value do we provide for private sponsors to get them to put up their money? And what about the government and the state? Because if you don't create value, people are not going to pay for it. If you ask for something but you don't give enough value back, they're not going to donate, they're not going to pay. So how do we define this value, and how does society look at it? And I think we need a new vision, and that's based on two things. There's a technology side, and there's a social side, and that's what I'm going to talk about. And when we talk about technology, that's frightening. Technology is frightening for most people, because it's so fast. And Eduardo Punset told me in a course, he said, doesn't make any sense anymore to be right wing or left wing. You have to be forwards or back. You either look towards the future or you're stuck in the past. And this is something that in Spain political parties don't get. And this is why they're doing so badly, because they don't realize that the thing is about to move forward. And then there's another important point. The technology revolution has been so huge that for people my age or older in general, we're completely at a loss. When I stand in front of my students and I see them handling technology that I can't use, they look at me and they wonder what I can teach them, because they feel my ideas are obsolete and ancient. And that's why they no longer respect teachers, because we can't teach them things that they will find relevant and useful. And we're teaching them other things that they feel will not be useful to them. And probably the people who are in government and who are making decisions, and I'm not criticizing the minister who was here this morning, but people who are making policies. One of our current MPs, are they the best people to design the education that a three-year-old will require to be socially productive when they are 20? Do they really know what these kids are going to need when most of them don't even know how to use a computer, when they come from a traditional educational system, when they want people to learn things by rote, when you can access everything from your phone by hitting a couple of keys? So you really have to change your mindset. And these young people, of course, we live in societies which value the young, which do not value the old, the ancient world, the traditional, the classic, and we have to realize that too. And everybody wants to be visible. I have a Facebook site, I post photographs, I post all day. I really want to be visible. And that's defining a individualistic attitude, which is really key. And then we need to find some sort of equilibrium, because of course there have been three levels in which we operate. Nature, we all feel happy in nature. The city, for example, everybody on the weekends rushes out of the city for the countryside. We look at nature and the countryside and we all smile. We feel that we are on holiday. We feel good. And we want to feel a certain equilibrium in the city. In the city, we will attend a concert or we will attend a football game. People will go shopping or go out for a drink or to dinner with friends. So the urban world, we have to combine with the natural world. And for a while, there was quite a good balance between the city and nature. And the city certainly makes you want to leave for the country on weekend, the city, because it's just too big and too hostile. In smaller cities, not so much. And then you have E3, which is what I call it, and that's the virtual world. It's a world that I can access through my phone, my laptop, television set. It's a world in which I'm spending more and more time sending emails, receiving emails, doing my work. I spend hours and hours and hours in this virtual world, which is no longer Homo sapiens, but Homo videns, because it's all visual. And we were talking about this morning, visual aspects of a performance, of a concert, enjoying that. And then we're seeing new devices. It seems that now it's all about smartphones, that we're all going to have smartphone bigger and bigger, and that's what we're going to use instead of PCs or even laptops. And it's more like tablets. And probably we'll end up with glasses that will serve as these devices. And it's a society which finds books boring. They'd rather jump from a link to another and go in and out and read different things about the same topic every day. They have no attention span. They're not used to reading a book from start to finish. They'd rather go here and there and not waste any time because their attention span is just so limited. It's impossible to retain somebody for 250 pages. Regardless of the quality of the suspense and the narrative. Our population is highly segmented, and Google knows exactly which 100 people are looking for a tennis racket in Spain right now. They know it. I don't have to post adverts everywhere. I don't need to, because I know exactly who's thinking of buying a tennis racket right now. So we're all segmented as consumers, and we have an increasingly detailed profile. And information has become a factor and a product. It was always a product, information, but now it's also valuable. You can have information that's worth a lot, and you're not using it. People who attend concerts, you could identify very easily. You could profile them, know who they are. And that's worth a lot for, say, a record company or for a lot of other companies, because that's a segmented audience, very specific profile who enjoy certain things. In an absolutely local world, it's even more useful. And then our world is a world in which values change really fast. People believe in God, they don't. Is there life after death? Not. I know that if I hit the switch on the wall, the light will go out, and then I can switch it on, and that solves problems in my life. But I'm beginning to forget about the big values. I'm focusing on very specific things. But technology hasn't given rise to social values, and that's causing a lot of complications. And we're seeing all kinds of different models. For instance, eBay. They started selling secondhand stuff, and now they sell just about everything. Or Amazon, which is even more diverse. It was books initially, where people recommended and reviewed the books. and the person who reviewed liked this book, bought this other book. And so I'd rather not follow the advice of advertising, but people who've actually read the book. And I want to hear their personal opinion of that book and the other books they've read. And that segments and gives information which had nothing to do with what came before. Then there's Google. It's not just the search engine. It's segmentation. It knows what you do, what you're planning to do, what you're planning to buy. And so based on Google's handling of massive information flows, business opportunities develop that are entirely new and that you have to know how to manage, because you have valuable data, you have valuable information, and that's the way you could advertise yourselves, attract donors, attract sponsors. And then, of course, there's the social media. This is 20, which young people use in Spain. It's like Facebook, but smaller. And this is the Spain-Italy game, remember, in the European Cup. And this is the broadband internet access. People on 20, as they were watching the game, then during the break, again, they're all on 20 and reviewing the game. And then the second half begins, and they're all once again watching the game. And then they're all again on 20 just before the penalty round. Everybody watches those, and then at the end of that, everybody gets back on 20. How many companies spent money buying advertising space here and here and here when 70% of the audience was actually on 20 and not watching the TV at all? The world has changed. The context has changed. People's attention span is different. And this Second Life, about 8 million people are on Second Life every day. If I don't like my life, I will create an avatar in Second Life, and I can be blonde and have green eyes or whatever I'd like to be, and with my avatar, I will live there and maybe clean some windows and earn some Kindle dollars. And then if I want to pick up this blonde in the corner, what I'm wearing is not enough. And Armani, the real Armani store, has opened a virtual store on Second Life, which will sell a T-shirt to my avatar, for which I will pay 80 real dollars. So we are living in this virtual world to some extent. People don't enjoy living in the city. They're not, it's not enough for them. And they're beginning to live more and more in this virtual world. And this is real money we're talking about. And they even had bank branches there, and they were lending money. And interest rates were higher in Second Life than in real life. And then they lent it there, and then they turned it into real money and repaid it and so on. So that's the point. We're moving to a world where, as the CEO of Google said, you don't actually have to tell me what you want, because I know what you want already. And that's where we live, in world of personal profiles, in which we are about to see a new internet era. Free internet is about to finish. We're moving into the cloud computing world. And in the cloud, the first to realize was this guy who decided not to have a USB port in the tablet. Because why? When you have the cloud, your company, your data, your computer, everything will be in the cloud. And who will control the cloud? Oracle, Amazon, Apple, Samsung, Google. So it's these companies that will contain all the information and therefore the power in the world. And that's the future. So first thing, technology. And let's think about society today. In society today, we have this table, which says, basically, what we were like earlier. From here, this is mass products, all identical. This end, products are almost tailor-made, customized. If I'm up here, I'm selling in a local market. And if I'm much higher up here, more global. The world in the 13th, 14th century was all traditional farming. Goods were sold that were all the same and sold in the local market. So it was all very local. And from that, we moved to handicrafts, which were more personalized, custom-made suits, but still sold locally. Then the Industrial Revolution. And so you start to see mass manufacturing, same product, and sold everywhere. Buy a Ford, whatever color you like, as long as it's black. But in today's e-business world, you can, from anywhere in the world, personalize your products. You can do things, tailor-made for any citizen anywhere in the world, and that's what you have to keep in mind. We've gone from a more or less traditional world in which there was a more or less clear structure where you knew who was in charge and where you didn't have a lot of possibilities of promotion, to May 68 and modernism, and all based on the concept that the future would be better than the past thanks to technology, and that therefore there will be more equality, more social progress, a more open society. And time went by, and it turns out that we didn't achieve what we dreamt of, and this is the postmodern world, which is more skeptical, and it raises some question marks about whether the future will always be better than the past, and about technology, and we all start thinking about ourselves and seeking our own feelings and happiness and satisfaction, and we become a hyper-individualistic world, and that's where we are now. It's a world which enjoys fashion. Fashion is all about breaking with the past. You like what's new, but it's about me. What I want is for me to be happy myself. I don't really care about the rest. And that's why we talk about liquid mobility. It's a society which starts boiling, say, like fluid. Occupy Wall Street, what have you. 2 days later, everyone's back home. It's like a fluid. It boils quickly and then cools quickly. We're not consistent. Political parties who have this concept of loyalty and membership and so on are done for, because the world is just not like that anymore. And in this hyper-individualistic world we live in, we seek sensations, feelings of freedom, beauty, a unique moment, it's an experience. I like to drive. It's all about experience. But listening to an orchestra, it's the experience. They seek experiences. That's the key element, and that's what we have to try and sell. And also you have to realize that in Spain we're pretty good at the hard side of experiences, but not so much about the soft part. The hard part, the hardware part, is, say, a nice ham sandwich. We have great ham, great bread, great oil. Product is great. So the hardware part I do really well, but the software side, if I throw it on a plate and throw it over the bar, people won't pay too much for it. If it's a really nice restaurant with amazing ambiance and views, you can sell that sandwich for 5 times more, because you're not paying for the sandwich, you're paying for the ambiance, the software. And how much of the soft side is there in your orchestras? Because that's the key. It's not about the hardware. Value creation, the reason why Germany is doing so well, it's not about the hardware side, which they do well, like so many others, but rather because of the whole experience side that they're able to create. So it's not so much about the quality-price ratio, because we all do that pretty well. It's about the experience, health, beauty, youth, and differentiation, identifying with certain characters or celebrities, pleasure, individualism, sensitivity. And now we have Porter's Rethinking Capitalism. Companies are not the problem, they are the solution. Companies have to help society, and that's where the donors, the sponsors come in. Patrons, and this is a paradigm that's going to gain ground. His article in the Harvard Business Review is becoming a corporate paradigm. It's like corporate social responsibility in the past, but differently. And also in times of crisis, when they're being blamed for everything, businesses, for the current crisis, and they've realized that they have to change. But there is a danger, because Spain has the same profile as the Japanese crisis of 1990 that they haven't yet emerged from. Same problem. So we have to find a way out, because in Japan right now, spending is unfashionable. Young people won't spend. It's just not cool. And so they're all at home in the virtual world, in front of their computer without buying anything. Is that where we're all going to end up? I don't know. What we need is a new value chain. And what that contains is information systems, ERP, enterprise resource planning. This is a new factor that can create value and improve efficiency. So we have to think about this new vision. And for a lot of people, going into the internet and into the digital economy means doing your accounts on a computer, or your inventories, or the customer database, or human resources and payrolls. That's not what it is.
But for all people, going into this world means having email, or doing everything mostly virtual, or having corporate design, or a corporatedominion.org, or a web page, information about what you do, but that's not what we're talking about. We're selling a product, we're selling tickets. Well, fine, but that's not what we're talking about either. It's not about online sales. So what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about going one step beyond that. This is what you see in the webpage of several orchestras, but you still have to go further. Companies are being set up in three different levels now. It's not the value chain, buy, produce, sell, no. What we need to do in this world of orchestras trying to manage their budget as best as possible is manage this vision. What matters the most is your front office, how to contact people. Well, you contact people at the theater, for instance. You take them to your seats, have them listen to the concert, but perhaps you're wasting other sources of connection, other channels. Maybe you don't only want to contact people going to the theater. You want to contact sponsors or patrons or people from the outside that can be potential customers, even your own workers. So we're going into a vision of things with these three layers, front office, middle office, and back office, all the resources. And your resources are the orchestra, basically. Whatever money you have, your people, your theater, those are your resources, those are your assets. And you have a model, a management model, and that's part of the front office, how people perceive you, how you contact them. So I don't have to be so concerned about the old three layers. It's about how you're seen, perceived, how you generate value for people. Everything else is back office. And it's middleware, which is how you manipulate the whole thing. That's the deal. If we do this, we can provide information on our products with absolute speed. When tickets are out, who our musicians are, we can launch messages on Facebook and WhatsApp. You're generating feelings. You generate a customized experience. You tell people what they want to hear. Just as Antonio was saying this morning, I believe, he said that there are tiny pills in some web page he visited. Well, that's good, but you can see the conductor saying, well, our rehearsal has just begun. You're trying to create this feeling of expectation so that people will attend the concert. And then there's the user experience. Sometimes we believe that we know that we have to tell people how to use a theater, how they should walk into a theater. Same thing happens with a web page, but no way. They have their own way of using things, and you're in the way. So you have to wonder how people do things, because people are used to having the world one click away, and if they don't, they go elsewhere. So the user experience is a key factor. I have to see if I can give everyone the product they need. Maybe some people would like to attend a rehearsal. Why not? For VIPs. Or some people would just like to listen to the highlights of certain things. Well, you can do that on your webpage. Other people don't have time for it, but they would like to hear the concert, watch the opera. Perhaps you can do it for them. You have to give each customer what they want and need. And yes, you need versions of products, but also you need versions of clients. Because we're dealing with a hyper-individualistic society. We're no longer dealing with a mass. And we cannot create value if we continue to see them as a mass. And we can also create a whole set of product of hard soft to create different feelings. And you have to focus on that. This is the website for the Metropolitan Opera from New York. It's a perfect website. They buy, they sell. You have plenty of stuff. But they don't identify people. Where's business intelligence here? Where's customized treatment? This one's a lot more about general info, pretty much like ours, I'm sure. So how can we raise feelings amongst these people? What do they expect from us? And if we cannot achieve this, we're lost. Because in a world where people are hiding behind their screens, they will end up listening to the Berlin Philharmonica with a super fast streaming computer with fantastic speakers. So whatever we do in our concerts has to go into a common platform that will be attractive. We need to generate feelings, customized experiences. We need to identify our audiences, because the better we identify them, the better we can sell them things. Maybe some companies just want a link in our page. They just want to advertise themselves in our web page. But at the same time, we can manage clients' data. We can sell the data of people, of opera goers. Actually, it's worth a lot of money, and that's an extra source of data. Well, obviously, under the Data Protection Act, etc. And also, that view of things behind the scenes, those little pills of knowledge. Maybe you're not going to a concert, you're following the concert from its inception. Rehearsals, explanations, you're hooked. And when you get to the concert, you live everything live. That's what we need to do. And maybe from your association, you have two possibilities. You can have a shared dissemination platform with contents that plenty of people from Spain and all over the world can see. You can set up that platform. And also a shared data system, some sort of software allowing each theater to detect important or relevant things for them. Data, customers, who attends concerts, who don't. That's the information you have is too vague. You can know so much more about your own business, so we need to change. We don't want to be on this ship. We need higher technology so that when the wind is not behind us, we can still go and go fast.